It's not like the sun comes up and the moon goes down kind of thing, where it's like light and day at the same, at different part times.
Wait a minute. The sun comes up and the moon goes down?
Yeah, you know, like...
Anita, we're going to have to talk about your scientific...
You know what I mean? Like the sun...
Please write in. Please leave comments.
You know what I mean, Ebony.
Do we have any astronomers?
Anyways.
Do we have any astrophysicists in the audience?
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 53. I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined by my amateur heist crew, Ebony Adams and Carolyn Pettit.
Amateur?
That's what I said.
Yeah, listen, I've been doing this a while.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we are the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today, we're diving into Steve McQueen's latest film, Widows, and then we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Now on with the show. Wow, that intro was really short.
Well, you know, you got to be efficient in this game. You got
to
have your...
Yeah, I feel like I keep cutting bits out of it to get it just like, boom, let's get on with it.
I mean,
let's get into the heart.
And now you've just, run over that time with the explanation.
Sure, but this is the intro banter. We have scheduled for this.
Oh my gosh. I was scheduled banter.
And you kept ruining my attempts to link it back to the film. And I'm like,
I'm so sorry.
The efficiency with which, a crew has to work and how they have to plan and train. We've done the planning and the training. We've been over it so many times. And now we can just get it done.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of efficiency, what's happening in entertainment news this week, Carol?
What a perfect segue, Anita, because, boy, there's so much to say about efficiency in the entertainment news this week. I think E3, we can all agree that E3, the big video game trade show, is just a model of efficiency. Interestingly, a fun fact, at the very first E3, the E3 being the... like the Electronic Entertainment Expo, I think is what E3 stands for, but we all would just call it
E3. It is E3. Three E's. Three E's, Carol.
So the first one was held in May of 1995. And at that event, Sony announced the release date and price point and everything of the first PlayStation. So kind of a historic, link there between E3 and the PlayStation. Now Sony has announced that for next year's E3, the 25th E3 happening in 2019, Sony will not have a presence at E3.
What?
Is
that why Microsoft said that they were going to be there?
Yeah, Microsoft, owning the competition by saying, yes, we are still going to participate in the bloated industry trade show. definitely just owning Sony.
Scrappy
with that
little
tweet.
Microsoft.
Yeah, tip exactly. So Sony released a statement, saying, quote, as the industry evolves, Sony Interactive Entertainment continues to look for inventive opportunities to engage the community. PlayStation fans mean the world to us, and we always want to innovate, think differently, and experiment with new ways to delight gamers. As a result, we've decided not to participate in E3 2019. It's just interesting that... there's been a lot of discussion, actually going back now for, gosh, at least it seems like 8 or 10 years, about the dwindling relevance of E3 as a video game event as game studios and publishers have more direct means of lines of communication open to people through just videos, and through their own kind of PR efforts and other things. And this really, strikes me as a definite blow to any perception of the ongoing relevance of E3. Though with that said, Activision, Bethesda, Capcom, Epic, Konami, Square Enix, Take-Two, Ubisoft, etc. are still, planning on being there.
Has there been rumors or conversation about actually why this is happening?
No, other than that, there's certainly speculation that Sony wants to announce or release the PlayStation 5 in 2020, and that maybe this taking this year off is going to position them more effectively to do that. That maybe they just don't feel like they have that much to show or announce this year.
Man, I wish that people would not do things like it's like CES, right? Where it's like every year you have to have some big thing to announce, and it's not like you have a cool thing every year. And E3 is the same way. Like, I wish people would just show up when they had something to actually have substance to show.
Yeah, and I think, you know, oftentimes developers, you know, will have to scramble and put a great deal of effort into sort of designing these very kind of well-crafted E3 demos, you know, just to show off the game at the trade show, but that just putting the demo together when the game is still fairly early in development, of course, can take so much time and work and resources away from the development of the game. And maybe there's just, you know, questions about whether, you know, companies like Sony see the returns on those kinds of investments that make them worthwhile. Any other entertainment news?
Is this more effective entertainment news?
Efficient.
Yeah.
Effective. Efficient. That's what it was. Efficient.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I'll let you be the judge. So you know who has a lot of opinions about things?
Me.
Bill Maher. Bill Maher.
Oh God.
Bill Maher has lots of opinions about things. And among the things about which he has opinions are comic books and the recent passing of a legendary, you know, comic book creator, Stan Lee. Bill Maher posted a blog post on his, I guess he has a blog, I don't know, on the official Real Time webpage, a blog post titled Adulting. And among the statements in that blog post is a fairly short blog post, but you know, it's he says, the guy who created Spider-Man and the Hulk has died, and America is in mourning, deep mourning for a man who inspired millions to, I don't know, watch a movie, I guess. You know, he goes on to say that when he was growing up or when he was a kid, you know, quote, the assumption everyone had back then, both the adults and the kids, was that comics were for kids. And when you grew up, you moved on to big boy books without the pictures. And he, the final, you know, thrust of his blog post is, quote, I don't think it's a huge stretch to suggest that Donald Trump could only get elected in a country that thinks comic books are important. So obviously this won him lots of affection and adoration from people. No,
you know, it really feels like desperately trying to get into the spotlight. It's just the dumbest thing to say.
Yeah. And it also feels so tired and hackneyed a take. Like, this is the kind of thing, that would have felt fresh 30 years ago. Like, I think the legislation on whether, you know, comic books or graphic novels or superhero films or pop culture in any sense, you know, sort of renders you non-adult, like consumption of those things. Like, we've all decided that's a bullshit position to take.
Yeah. And like, I mean, it's slightly frustrating for me as somebody who thinks, you know, I have these like mild concerns about, like, gosh, I don't really like how huge the superhero, you know, movie industrial complex has become. I don't like that they are now these like massive corporate products, and that they have so much like cultural impact in my mind at the expense of other kinds of films. Like, studios are pouring so much into funding, you know, superhero movies that I think other types of films and are kind of suffering a bit. But you know. But then I hear somebody say something like this, and I'm like, oh my God, dude, no, like, no, like, you know, it's frustrating, because I mean, I think there are, to an extent, there's legitimate conversations to be had around this issue, but not, like, framing it like that. I mean, it's just embarrassing, and it's just, It's awful. It's so awful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Bill Maher's whole shtick that, you know, he's this kind of like straight talking iconoclast that will, you know, take controversial positions, you know, that other people, you know, usually liberals are afraid to take while still seeking cover from what's called liberalism in this country is so tired. And also, like, dude is straight up racist and transphobic. Like, he been trash, but... Welcome to the party, everyone who's now pissed at Bill Maher. We been new. Bye.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, if this is the threshold where you're finally getting angry at Bill Maher because he said something about comic books, like, then maybe you and I have to talk because, like, you should have been pissed at Bill Maher a long time ago. Like,
seriously.
So, like, you know, this is kind of small potatoes in the scheme of, like, him saying things that are actually, like, truly deeply offensive, but still, like, definitely, definitely a bad, bad, bad take and a bad look on his part.
All right. Good news.
Good news. The best. You can always count on me to bring the best.
Did you know that we can keep bringing Feminist Frequency Radio to the airwaves because of you? It's true. If you're enjoying our show, please consider joining our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. You'll get access to some fun perks and bonus episodes. So that's d.rip/femfreak. Love it. Let's move on to the main segment for this week. We're talking about Steve McQueen's latest film, Widows, which takes us on a heist. Takes us on a heist film, which is accurate, but now it sounds weird that I'm saying it out loud. Cool. It's a heist film with an interesting premise. The widows of a crew of thieves decide to get in on the game. Viola Davis stars in the film, along with a pretty exceptional cast, who all have the most amazing arms. Yeah, we got to talk about that.
Yeah.
So including Elizabeth Debicki, Michelle Rodriguez, Carrie Coon, and Cynthia Erivo. Can we just first immediately talk about the fact that Carrie Coon was aggressively underused and it made me very upset?
I had no argument or I had no issue with the amount of time she was
She is
screen.
Such an amazing actor that I think it's a travesty to not use her more. Not her character necessarily, but like her as an actor.
So I'm not familiar with her as an actor from
There's one
else.
Episode of The Leftovers that she should have won like every goddamn award for. She's incredible. And y'all need to watch that show still.
Are you bringing
Leftovers drama? Into this discussion of widows?
It's not drama. I'm just saying she's amazing.
Is she the one who has the newborn baby? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. She Amanda. Definitely her character, is definitely underused. I would have liked to have gotten more of her in the film.
Well, I think, you know, let's talk about the film and the story, right? Because this comes from a television series in England from the 80s, written by Linda LaPlante, who was the genius mind behind Prime Suspect. So, you know, over the course of that series, you are able to flesh out all of these different stories more. But I found the way that this film was put together incredibly effective. We don't learn much about Amanda, but I didn't, you know, having not come into this as a Carrie Coon fan, I didn't recognize it as a loss that we don't see her more. And I certainly wouldn't have wanted, given, you know, a 2-hour runtime, to spend more time with her, which would require less time or the non-existence of the character of Belle, who was amazing. Just fucking amazing. Cynthia Erivo, like, from the running, the punching, her hair, her body, the way she stood up to Viola Davis, she was the best.
Yeah, I don't know her as an actor, and I was like, who are you? How? Why aren't you in everything all the time?
She has been recently, she's going to be playing Harriet Tubman, I believe, in an upcoming picture. And there was a lot of talk on Black Twitter, which is, you know, the side of Twitter I hang out on, about whether it was, you know, appropriate or whether it was, you know, a choice that made kind of artistic sense to have a Black British woman playing this, you know, historical American figure. You know, and there was a lot of conversation, some of it very interesting and thoughtful, some of it kind of less so and knee jerk. But yeah, she's done tons of stuff.
So yeah. I'm fascinated I actually was unaware of the connection you mentioned, Ebony. So Prime Suspect it's definitely on the very short list of my favorite TV series of all time. For those who aren't familiar, it's a kind of, you know, long running British series that stars Helen Mirren as Detective Jane Tennyson. And what I think is so fantastic about Prime Suspect is the way that it's very human. I mean, the character of Tennyson and all the characters are very fleshed out and three-dimensional, but also all the crimes that she investigates and that the series is concerned with are deeply rooted in, like, socio-political, you know, or economic context, you know, context issues of race, issues of class, and, you know, and gender identity, sexuality, and so on. And so I went into Widows not knowing. I was actually expecting a pretty straightforward kind of heist movie. I hadn't seen any of the trailers or anything, and I figured at a certain point, you know, I'm just going to go into this movie not knowing what I'm going to get. And man, I was surprised. Like, this film is, like, deeply concerned with, like, Chicago politics,
yes,
but, like, local, like, kind of local politics, the corruption of local, you know, corruption in local politics, and obviously setting it in Chicago specifically. Like, it's a very distinctly a Chicago film, though, of course, the issues of financial corruption that it focuses on or that are involved in the story have relevance in other places. And there's so much interesting stuff about race, like, embedded in the kind of core, the setup or the stuff around the heist in this film, because you have Colin Farrell as, like, a, I don't know, sixth generation, you know, I think Irish, Chicago, you know, his dad was, like, alderman of this district, and he's now running for alderman. He's the front runner, and you know, running against a black man. But you know, like, there's corruption in Colin Farrell's character's sort of political machinations, in the sense that he, you know, he presents himself as this figure who's, like, so supportive of, like, women, you know, women owning businesses and things like that. And he'll make campaign stops and, like, have women, women of color business owners kind of get up on stage and, you know, have a little kind of quote unquote success story moment. But really, like, the way, as we eventually kind of learn, there's so much corruption and exploitation in those schemes, in the way that he quote unquote helps those women get their businesses started. And, you know, the fact that the film finds a way to kind of embed these concerns about larger issues in what is also, you know, this story of this group of women who are brought together through kind of unlikely circumstances to pull off a heist together, I found really fascinating.
I did too. And I think, you know, although the film, like, if you haven't watched the trailers for it or haven't done any reading for it, and all you know is the kind of, you know, superficial takes on the film that have been going around, and you expect to see a heist movie, you will be disappointed on that score, because although there is a heist in this film, it isn't even the centerpiece of this film. It gets, you know, fairly, you know, short treatment, and it comes very late in the film, but it's by no means kind of the climax, either emotionally or narratively in the film. This film is about so much more. And so you're not going to get a kind of like Ocean's 11 or Ocean's 8 kind of film. This is not about, like, a group of, you know, like, sassy, plucky, you know, kind of witty criminals coming together, you know, pulling off one last job, laughing, joking, whatever. That's not what this is about. I mean, this film in many ways is a meditation on grief, absolutely about Chicago politics and, like, the particular flavor of corruption in Chicago politics, particularly at, like, the hyper local level. Like, we're talking about an alderman's race. We're not talking about the mayorship. We're not talking about the governorship of Illinois. We're talking about an alderman's race. And yet so much power, so much influence is bound up in those positions. And I found it so interesting that Colin Farrell, who is an actor, like, I've never really cared about too much, but I thought he was fantastic.
He plays a smarmy, shitty, privileged dude so well.
He absolutely does.
Like, I feel like he's played this role a couple of times in the past.
But I feel like he's gotten so much better at it as he's gotten older and invested it with some real depth that perhaps, to me anyway, he didn't necessarily have as a younger actor. But I found it so interesting, Kira, you were talking about, like, the legacy that his character comes from, this, like, political you know, Irish Catholic Chicago family, right? And Colin Farrell talks about his dissatisfaction with occupying that space. He ultimately would rather be doing something else, you know? Like, he's tired of this. And yet, then you contrast that with Jamal Manning, who is desperately trying to get into it because he says, I want that life. Like, he and, you know, the Black people in that community of the 18th Ward, they have not had the opportunity to grow tired of power, that particular kind of power, right? Like, he wants that. And, but, you know, contrast with Mulligan, who's like, I didn't want this. I didn't want to be like my father. I don't want this kind of, like, you know, backslap. Of course, he's happy to do it once he's in it, but
I think that there's some interesting moments in the film, one in particular where Colin Farrell's character with his assistant are in the backseat of a car and you can't see them. It's just
so
a
good
shot where you just see the, like, the passenger side of the car, and then you see all of the background. So you see this community going from, like, you know, sort of desolate, like, impoverished to wealthier just through this drive. And what's his name? Farrell's character,
Mulligan.
Jack Mulligan.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. He is asking his assistant if she's ever fucked a Black dude. And it's just, it's a really fucked up, like, uncomfortable conversation. And it just slowly pans to the driver, who's sort of out of focus, but the driver is the Black dude in the car where this conversation is happening. And that, like, there's a number of scenes in this movie that I think are really powerful. Visually really stimulating. I will say, though, I am definitely one of those people that was disappointed it wasn't a heist movie. And I think that that has a lot to do with the fact that it was, like, I think we have a problem with the way that trailers are presented in general, because, like, you know, I was like, this is going to be a heist movie with all these badass women of color, and it's going to be awesome, and it's going to be dark and gritty, and it's going to be like Heat, and it's going to, you know, like, or whatever, right? It's going to be something like not bubbly like Ocean's 8, but like deep and dark and intense, and it's going to be women who people don't think can pull it off. And that's not what this movie is. So I actually was pretty, like, I was disappointed in it, and I feel like I need to kind of rewatch it now knowing that it's a different film, because it felt, I kept wanting to, like, get to it, right? Like, I wanted to see a lot more of, like, the struggle. Like, the fact that these women are trying to pull off a heist and they don't know what the fuck they're doing is such an interesting story to me, that, like, she's like, go get a gun. And, like, watching her figure out how to get a gun, right? Like, what are these maps to? Like, what is this blueprint to? And, like, I want to see more of them, like, overcoming the adversity of not knowing how to be criminals and figuring it out.
See, I didn't want that. And precisely because I think there is this glossy sheen that, you know, we have become accustomed to, and, you know, what's termed these heist movies, right? This kind of glamour that we attach to criminal enterprises. And what I loved about this film is how it demonstrates just the sort of, like, sheer workmanship of it, you know? Just the kind of, like, banal duties and responsibilities you have to go through.
Yeah, but they don't know what those are. Like, that's what's interesting is if we got to see more of, like, how fucking hard it is to actually learn how to do that without any support.
Right. Well, I agree there. But I guess what I'm saying is that what I loved about it is that ultimately what the film suggests is that it doesn't pulling off something like this, obviously, you know, it takes a whole lot of luck, but mainly it just takes the sheer will. Like, the sheer will these women demonstrated was ultimately, like, making the decision to do this and watching them come to that decision was what was most fascinating for me.
I kind of agree with Anita in the sense that, like, this film, it has such a strong opening, you know, so the very opening, obviously, so the title of the movie is Widows. I don't think it gives anything away in the premise to say that, you know.
It happens so fast.
Yeah. So, like, at the very beginning, what we're largely seeing is, like, the job of the husbands of all the women who become central to the film, like, their kind of last heist, of course, that, of course, goes terribly wrong and they end up getting killed. Like, it is such a it is so well shot, so well like directed. It's such an exciting opening to the film. You have this scene where you're like, look, this shot where you're looking backwards out the getaway van, and the, you know, the police cars are like pursuing them, and it, none of it seems like CGI or whatever. It all seems like practical effects and things, you know, these cars kind of wrecking, you know, as they're like, as they're in hot pursuit of the van. And it just feels very, you know, it's a very kind of just muscular, like weighty, very, very powerful opening scene that, and I was like, oh man, Steve McQueen, you know, he knows how to do this kind of stuff. Like he, you know, the comparison to Heat, I think, is an apt one. Like part of what makes Heat such a beloved kind of example of a heist film is the way that everything in that film feels like it has weight to it. Like it really feels, you know, hefty, and, you know, everything, the guns and just the process itself. And so I was disappointed that given how strong that opening was and how much McQueen demonstrates himself capable of doing that kind of action, that we didn't get more of that in the film. But at the same time, I was pleasantly, as somebody who loves, you know, the sort of stories that interweave, you know, kind of genre crime stuff with like larger social concerns, I was like really pleasantly surprised by how much the film is concerned about those. So Liam Neeson is in the group of men who's killed like very early on in the film, but he's the husband of Viola Davis's character. And, you know, like I was fascinated by how, as the film goes on, we learn more about like the history of their marriage. I mean, she was so devoted to like their marriage, just like the love that she's just wrecked by grief after he's gone. But, you know, we learn things about the history of their marriage too, that really put that, you know, their marriage is very complicated by the fact that he is white and she is black, right? And ultimately, like that, in a way too, becomes this kind of galvanizing wedge that runs through the film, ultimately, in a way that I didn't expect or didn't see coming. And I thought that was, I mean, it's tough to talk about without like giving too much away, because it's revealed so carefully as the film progresses. But man, I thought that was so I that whole aspect of the film I just love. Like I think it just says so much about like how the complications that a person has to shoulder, in a way, by like a white person, a white man has to kind of shoulder by being in a relationship with a black woman. And like, oh, how nice it would be. Oh, how nice it would be if you didn't have to like deal with those things. Right. And just kind of, I'm talking around certain things here, but I really think that the things I'm talking around are worth kind of
seeing
the film
it.
For and like thinking about.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to spoil it, but I do want to nod to those things as things that I think make this film, help make it the interesting film that it is.
Yeah, I don't think that they actually do show the process of getting to the point of doing the heist. I think that it was, you know, Viola gets this book, or Veronica in the book. Viola Davis is amazing in this, by the way. Just
so
that needs
amazing.
To be like, I know we haven't said that explicitly, and I think that she carries this film incredibly. But you know, like we see these moments of intimacy, but I don't think that we actually get a good look into her process of why she chose to go the route that she went instead of the obvious route, right?
Mm-hmm. Which would be book. What?
Which would be selling the book. So you know, when she decides that she's going to do this heist, like there's not, like it takes a while to get to that point, but I don't think that was really worked out. And I think that there's a lot more time spent on the Alderman's, what's their names again?
Mulligan and Manning.
Mulligan. I keep forgetting to put their names on it. I keep writing their names down. Anyways, I don't know. Like, I'm having a really hard time. I mean, I just watched it like last night, so I haven't had a lot of time for it to sink in yet. But I like what it's trying to say. I like that it's saying the things that it's saying. I like that it's packaged up in this conversation about institutional racism on many levels within society and within like Chicago specifically. But like, it just didn't wow me in the way that I thought it would.
I the decision that Veronica makes to pull off this last job, to me, made perfect sense as a way of connecting her to the husband that she is grieving so intensely. You know, much is made of the fact that she has remained, although she knows what her husband does, she has remained separate from that life, almost entirely separate. So she doesn't know details. She doesn't know names. She has to beg Bash repeatedly to learn the names of the men who are in Harry's crew. And so to me, it made perfect sense that, you know, given these two horrible options to approach the man who has just, you know, violently intimidated you in your home, and sort of, you know, come to him begging and say, you know, is this book, will you take this book in payment for the debt? Or to try and, you know, do this thing that your husband has laid out. It made sense to me. Is it a smart choice?
Yeah, now that you say it that way, I feel like it, like I see that now that it was said. I didn't pick that up. Which is not necessarily a fault of the movie, but like that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this film in a lot of ways, like the relationship to me of this film to other films that are more, you know, explicitly heist films is the difference between something like, you know, a James Bond movie or a Mission Impossible film versus something like a John le Carré novel, you know, or like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Like they're both ostensibly are about spy craft, but they go about it in such separate, different ways. And in, you know, the latter example, you would be forgiven for almost being bored by the way these men who are engaged in spycraft go about their business. They are not flashy. They don't drive, you know, flashy cars. The work they do is not meant to wow you. It is very businesslike. They want to sort of, you know, retire into the background or be invisible in a way. And I think this film, in a lot of ways, you know, has that sort of relationship to heist films. You know, it's not about wowing you with kind of these set pieces or, you know, acrobatics, like cinematic acrobatics in a way. I don't know. I was incredibly impressed by the film.
Do you feel, there's a part of me that sort of feels like it was trying to do too much. I really don't think we should spoil it. So I'm just going to say that, like, there's a couple of things that happened towards the end, including the stuff with the son, that I'm like, oh, like, you're just piling shit on now. Even though I think that those stories are important, it felt like too many stories and too many points. And it wasn't like, it didn't like nuance together or like meld together enough where it felt natural as much as it felt like it was like, oh, we have to hit this point and this point and this point.
So I would argue that, I mean, to me, my sense of it was that actually what it's doing by doing so much is kind of saying, like, look, all these things are connected and you can't, like, you know, like our personal, the way race or, you know, for instance, impacts our personal individual lives and the way race exists in the larger political sphere and the way that, you know, money and political corruption and this and that, like that all these things are part of, that they're all part of larger systems. Right. And so to me that wound up being kind of essential to what I saw the movie as doing, as kind of outlandish, maybe as some of it is a bit, I was just so on board with what I was like admiring the film by that point. I was admiring the film for being so deliberate in its effort to kind of buck the like heist movie genre kind of formula that I'm like, oh, okay, like, sure. Yeah, sure. Let's bring in all this stuff, you know, like.
I also suspect that because it was a TV show, first of all, there's like a bunch of stuff that they added specifically, but that weren't in the TV show. But I think that with a TV show, because I before I knew it was a TV show, I left the movie going, man, I wish this was a miniseries, because I feel like it needed more time to like breathe and needed more time for character development and like The motivations behind characters and that sort of thing. So like now I'm kind of curious and kind of want to go back and watch the movie.
I'm the show, always the ready TV to show. Watch some crime drama with you, Anita.
Let's do it.
Foreign crime drama. That's my business. Actually, one of the things that I was thinking, and I'll bring this up when we get to the What's Your Freak Out section, but one of the things that I loved about this movie, about Steve McQueen's work in general, is that he is so assured as a director. You feel as if every choice is so deliberate. Nothing is accidental. And although it may, you know, occasionally take you a moment to catch up to where he is trying to go, I was always confident that he was going somewhere. And so, you know, you reference that scene where Mulligan and his assistant are in the back of that car, and we very quickly go from an economically, you know, depressed area to upscale area, which I think is Hyde Park. But it takes minutes. Mere minutes, and the worlds look completely different, right? And so the way that is shot, I was so impressed by. But then another shot that I was just blown away by is when we first, after we first met Belle in the salon, which is the character played by Cynthia Erivo, she comes home, she's at her apartment just for seconds, it seems like, greeting her daughter, gets a call, we learn, to babysit Linda's children, but she has to run for the bus. And so the conversation on the phone where, you know, no, I can't take a cab, I can be there in 20 minutes. And she takes off running and it gets faster and faster, racing for the bus. My heart was in my chest. I loved the way that was shot. And I felt it viscerally, because in that moment you see her running and you, all of her concerns and the weight of her class position are bound up in that run, because you know that if she misses that late night bus, there's not going to be another one for a while. She doesn't have the money to get a cab. Like, I just thought it's for such a simple scene. So much was communicated. I loved this movie. I loved it.
Yeah. And, you know, to sort of I want to say a little bit about the sort of Alice, the subplot of the character Alice.
Oh, yes.
Who, you know, very much in sort of opposition to Belle. Alice is this, you know, very pretty white woman who, you know, she starts dating. She like signs up, I guess, on a service that where they pair women with, like,
she becomes an escort. And her, yeah, the shit with her mother, like, trying to talk her into doing it, yeah, like, broke me.
That was amazing. But also, like, I was so fascinated by how, you know, she meets this man who probably, like, in the scheme of things, in terms of, like, the men you're going to meet through that kind of arrangement, that kind of service, like, probably seems like a quote-unquote, like, a nice guy or, like, one of the good guys. And yet, like, he, you know, this wealthy, this rich, I don't know, architect or something. And he himself, like, wants her only as, like, a kept woman. He does not want to, like, let her into his life in any kind of real way. And, like, the you know, when she kind of realizes that, and, like, how, I don't know, like, how she herself is in this kind of a very different kind of trap, but it's in its own way, it's a terrible trap too, where her life, she's not valued as, like, a human being, as a person, right? She's just this possession, this, like, attractive thing to be kept, and how she really, like, chafes against that.
And to be abused.
Oh, yeah.
That was a really strong theme in her life, and in her character, and her trying to fight,
yes,
like, finally empowering herself to fight the, like, constant abuse that everyone in her life throws at her.
Yes.
I had a really interesting experience watching this movie. I also watched it last night, and I was in a theater where the reactions of my fellow moviegoers were occasionally kind of oppressive. Like, they laughed at odd moments. And there was a woman, an older woman, sitting next to me, separated by one seat. And at certain points in the movie, like, she would lean way forward and look at me just, like, in shock. You know,
as oh, if, that like is she, so uncomfortable.
Yeah, as if she also needed to see my reaction and have me, you know, react with her to these very shocking moments. It was something. But one moment really stuck with me. So the scene that you were referencing, Kara, where Alice and her mother are talking, I think it's just like a week or two after her husband has died, and her mother's asking her how much money she has now, and she's like, I don't have any. We spent it. You know, what did you get for the things that you sold? $3,000, whatever. And so the mother tells her about this escort service and says, and she talks about it like what it is, labor. She says, there'll be benefits. There will be bonuses. You know, if you're sweet and you do the work, you know, you can survive with this. And then she says, you know, and these girls, like you can go to college with this money. And the women, it was mostly women in the theater I was in, laughed uproariously at that line.
Really?
Yeah. And I was so uncomfortable with that and so angry because it was very dismissive laughter. Like, where do you get off thinking that your daughter or you could ever aspire to do something else? You know, if you participate in, you know, sex work economy, that is who you are. That is all you are good for. That is all you will ever be. The notion of you going to college or doing something else, you know, is ridiculous on its face.
You need to get out of the suburbs.
Dude, it was fucked up. It was really fucked. I will also say that, you know, and go back to my new segment idea, Trailer Trash, one of the trailers before this film was What Men Want. The crowd was fucking eating it up. They cannot wait for that movie. And I was just like, I cannot do, no. Not on my watch. I will not
so
be there.
So we're going to be talking about that on a future episode, huh?
Like, who's we, homie?
This might be one of those situations like where Carolyn went and watched Ready Player One because we refused to do it.
Right. No, totally. Oh, but the last thing I wanted to say about the Alice bit is that it was such an effective mirror for that scene when we see, oh God, now I'm blanking on a name. The character played by Daniel Kaluuya, Jamal's brother.
Oh, right.
So when he is, and first of all, Daniel Kaluuya, it is rare to have someone convey that level of menace and malevolence so effective. Like, he's legitimately terrifying. But he's in his car at one point during the film listening to Albert Fox, one of the Angola Nine, speak. And he's talking about how sometimes and in some situations for some people, it doesn't matter how much you try, how much you try and get out. It doesn't matter if you play by the rules or not. You are always going to be in the shit and nothing ever, ever is going to change. And I just thought that was such, you know, an interesting mirror for Alice's circumstance later when she's, you know, kind of having the scales fall from her eyes when the guy that she's met from the escort service reveals, like, no, this is never going to be anything else. I don't want anything else from you. I'm never going to take you to where I live. You know, it's never going to be more than this. The way that she's having to labor under that same, you know, realization, like for some people, things never, ever change. No matter how much you try, no matter how much you, you know, make the effort to play by the rules and do things correctly, you know, you're always going to be stuck in this position.
Yeah. So we are out of time for this, but I'd like to how do you feel about having a spoiler talk in the bonus?
Let's definitely
talk
about it.
Because I actually want to talk about how my audience reacted, and I can't do that without spoiling some things.
Let's do it. And also, Anita, you and I talk about something you haven't brought up, which is that Marcus from Elementary is in this film.
I know! Oh my God, I was like, I immediately was like, oh, I gotta text Stephanie, and then was like, wait, I can't text Stephanie right now. Oh, he was so good too. It was so weird to see him as like
he was so good, and I definitely have thoughts about that because you're talking about like local politics, you know, in the Black community, if you don't involve the Black church in some way, your shit is false. So I was so glad they did that. Anyways, let's talk about it in the bonus.
All right, let's move on to what's your freak out. Carolyn, you want to get started on that?
Sure.
My Freak Out is a film, it's a film called Lean on Pete, which is a film directed by Andrew Haigh, H-A-I-G-H. I don't actually know if I'm saying his last name correctly, but this director came onto the scene some years ago with a film called Weekend, which is this British film about a gay man who hooks up with another gay man, and it's sort of, initially kind of feels like just kind of one night stand, but he finds himself really kind of shaken or feeling connected to this person. And, so Weekend is a lovely, lovely film. And Lean on Pete, I watched it on a plane recently. Film
Humble
I've been
brag.
Wanting to see for a while. Yeah, wow, I watched a movie on a plane, y'all. And so Lean on Pete is a film about a young, like a 15-year-old boy living with his father in serious poverty in the, I think, Portland, Oregon area, like the larger, maybe Portland, Oregon area. And, something happens to his father where his father is hospitalized. And the amount of desperation that that the two of them feel or that results for them from this, because, there's no health insurance, there's no nothing, like, and with, if the dad's not earning money, they're screwed. And so this young man named Charlie kind of gets a job working at working for this ornery older man played by Steve Buscemi, who runs horses. He runs horses into the ground at various kind of small time racetracks and stuff. And anyway, the young man kind of forms a bond with one of the horses. That horse is named Lean on Pete, hence the title of the film. And, without kind of going, things happen. It becomes a kind of journey, like a road journey of a film. But it's so much about, again, just kind of speaking of films that are like about larger things. This is a film about poverty. It's about the ways in which in our society, if you cannot be productive under capitalism, you are kind of deemed like truly worthless. And it's about the deep, deep, deep shame that we instill in people who find themselves in that position, and it's basically, it's a film that is very clearly and very strongly saying like, no, I mean, our lives do have value and have meaning, like totally irrespective of our ability to be productive under capitalism. It's a very sensitive, gentle, kind of slow film. In my mind, a really lovely film. The one thing I'll say about it, like, of course, thinking about it afterwards, is that, Charlie, the main character, and his dad, they are white, and like, as horrible as his experience is throughout the film because of the desperation that he's in and because of his poverty, like, of course, I couldn't help but think, like, oh, but this thing that he's doing right now, like, this situation that he's in right now, like, would be even worse or would be, different if he were black, for instance, like, knocking on a stranger's door and just asking for water, right? Like, as he's kind of parched and, like, walking these long distances, it's like, that would be a very differently charged kind of fearful thing perhaps for a young black man to do than it is for him. And the film doesn't like engage with that, with how even within this like awful, awful circumstance, he still has some kind of privilege because of his whiteness. But, nonetheless, like it's a really lovely, tender film that I think says something that's obviously very important and very like near and dear to my heart. So yeah, I recommend it. Check out Lean on Pete by Andrew Haigh.
Nice. Ebony, what's your freak out?
I have been rewatching Killing Eve. So watched it,
I'm ruining your freak out. But I just like, I'm like four episodes in now, four or five. I hope to finish it on my next trip. I'm excited.
Yay.
So don't spoil it for me.
I will not. This is not about anything that happens in it. But so I've been rewatching it and it occurred to me, this is such a base level realization, but it hadn't hit me in quite the thudding way that it did this weekend when I was rewatching it. But I realized that one of the reasons why I am so intensely attached both to crime drama and thrillers of the sort that Killing Eve is part of is because I am so overjoyed to look at middle-aged women. Crime drama, particularly foreign crime dramas, but you know, in this country as well, is one of the few genres in which you can reliably count on there being older women giving somewhat substantial roles. And it's really interesting and odd to think about that, you know, when it comes to certain types of crime drama, particularly the more kind of, you know, vicious and violent among them, that a genre that is devoted to eradicating women and eliminating women and watching us, you know, having us sort of consume the elimination of usually young women relies upon so heavily the presence of older women to kind of restore justice or to find out the truth. So it's just something I've been wrestling with, but yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's about something about as I get older, there's something about the sorts of faces that I respond to, but I was rewatching Killing Eve and there were, you know, Sandra Oh is someone who I could just look at for hours. And like Viola Davis, same way. So it was very interesting to watch Widows in the same weekend that I was rewatching Killing Eve, because there are moments of close-ups on these phenomenal actors and the way their faces are shaped and the way they carry their age and the kind of beauty that comes through that and the sort of quiet strength they both demonstrate, and the way that they are both prickly characters in ways that I don't think we really allow younger women to be on screen. Yeah, so my freak out for the week is middle-aged women. Love them.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. So I either have no freakouts or too many freakouts, which is definitely my problem.
Holy shit. Week, can we get a supercut, Phil, of Anita introducing her freakouts this way every week?
Yeah, because that's what happens every week. Uh-huh. I either have too many or too little, and then it's a disaster, and I have to pick one, and I don't know what to do. You know what I should do is I should write them down and then bring back the old ones, but that doesn't happen, so whatever. All right, this week I am freaking out about Charlie Jane Anders' new book, The City in the Middle of the Night. It is not out yet. I was really lucky to get an advanced copy of it.
Humble brag.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Is it a humble brag or is it just bragging?
Straight up brag.
So I really loved her first book, All the Birds in the Sky. And so I was really excited to read this one. And it was a little bit harder for me to get into at the beginning. But once I did, I was like, oh, bring it. I think that she builds these incredible environments that are filled with fascinating characters, which, I mean, that's what a good story should be, but like the imagination that she has is just it's constantly like I'm in awe of it. So for example, it takes place on this ostensibly dying planet, and there's this really interesting thing where you know, the sun doesn't like, it's not like the sun comes up and the moon goes down kind of thing, where it's like light and day at the same at different part times.
Wait a minute. The sun comes up and the moon goes down?
Yeah, you know, like
Anita, we're going to have to talk about your scientific.
You know what I mean? Like the sun, we have both night and day. Oh, fucking, you know what I mean, Ebony. Anyways.
Please write in. Please leave comments on this. Do we have any astronomers? Do we have any astrophysicists in the audience? Please.
I'm trying to be sorry, go ahead. Here. Anyway, shut the fuck up.
I'm never going to get over that. Okay. And the moon goes down. Okay.
Anyways, it's a really interesting thing where there's different parts of the city that are always dark and different parts that are always light. And it changes the dynamic of what's happening in those spaces. And there are two totally different cities that have completely different operating structures and have different political, you know, political and social structures and the tensions between those. she brings in these, like, you know, incredibly intelligent beasts that have a, like, that that are misunderstood. And within all of that, the book is constantly talking about trauma and global warming and political structures. And it just, like, it's just so, like, deep commentary on capitalism, ideas about origin, originalness, like who is the first to be in a place and what does that mean? It's so, there's so much going on, and it's so, it's weaved together so beautifully that it never feels like, oh, this is the point that is being made now. It's more like, it's just woven into this really incredible story with really, really fascinating characters. So I highly recommend it. It comes out in February. I assume you can pre-order it now. It's called The City in the Middle of the Night by Charlie Jane Anders. All right. That's our show. If you want to submit your own freakout, you can. Just head over to femfreak.com/freakout, F-R-E-Q-O-U-T. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. And stay tuned for the bonus episode, which is only available as a backer of this podcast, which can be you. So just head over to d.rip/femfreak. And if you're enjoying the show, please rate and review us on iTunes. Mm-hmm. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Femfreak to stay up to date on all the news. You can find us individually. I am at Anita Sarkeesian.
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
I'm at Harry Rollins Notebook.
Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music, technical support by Sarah Norales, production assistance by Taylor Simmons, and art by Jamie Barron. We'll see you next week.
Bye. Bye.